Today is Monday, May the 2nd. This is a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 5512, which I will open. Welcome to the table, Madam Chief of Staff, and ask you to begin your Phase 2 high-level overview of the Governor's Office.
Thank you so much. For the record, I am Teresa McHugh, Chief of Staff for the Governor's Office. Again, a recap, and I believe you all have a handout, but again, to remind everyone that the mission is to provide leadership and direction for all state government operations within the executive branch of government. So, again, that is the start of that. We did put a priority order together for the Governor's Office. It basically starts with basic administration of the office. Not a surprise, the Governor's Office is almost all people. Driven. It is not an office that has a lot of other costs in terms of services and supplies and those costs. The primary driver is people, and the administration is what you would normally run into in the way of policy advisors, the press office, and basic administration. The economic revitalization team is next, and again, that's...
I'm going to stop you, if you don't mind, just to make sure that we're all on the same page. You're working in the blue presentation document.
Right.
Under phase two. I apologize.
No problem. Again, the economic revitalization team is fairly recent addition to the governor's office, but was the goal of this team, as been discussed last session and this one, is to go out and work with communities and bring government agencies together to solve problems in those communities and to look for ways to really foster economic development throughout the state. And as we go further in the presentation, we will have more information on that in response to, obviously, there were a lot of questions about this last time, and Ray Knapp is here with us today and actually dressed up and wore a tie for us, so we want
to... We'll have to be sure to call him forward, given that he's gone to the extraordinary effort.
That's right, and he can give you more information on that, as well as on the Office of Rural Policy. Again, that's a fairly new construct discussed last session, and then an executive order establishing the office. Ray will also talk about that, as well as answer the questions that came up last time about the project specifically, and whether there's ways to look at things like rural health specifically and how that interacts with the economic revitalization team. After that, we have units that... have been added to the governor's office over time that have existed in other places. The first is the Advocate for Minority Women and Emerging Small Businesses. This is a group that at one point existed, and I'm not sure if it was the Department of Consumer and Business Services at that time or Department of Insurance and Finance, but existed there. There's still an element there, but what happened was the legislature separated the two into the group that actually just does certification and into an advocate's office to go out and make sure we were doing our job with all of the contracts that exist in the statewide effort. Over 200 to make sure we were reaching out to these communities and these businesses.
Ms. McHugh, three of us serve on another committee in the afternoon together, and mm-hmm. as we have seen the different agencies come forward that have pockets of minority women emerging,
right.
There has been some discussion about could they all be in one place? How do you find them in the phone book? If the idea is to encourage those folks that are entrepreneurs within those definitions, how do we make it simpler? And I don't know whether or not, given your long service in state government, if you have a perspective on any attempts to try to reamalgamate those folks someplace, and if so, where would be an appropriate place to do that?
Madam Chair, I think one of the issues there in terms of if we were to look at bringing some element of them together would still be probably a separation of the advocate and that function from the other functions. What had happened over time was that the advocate became more of an advocate for serving, if you will, with the certification unit for the government side of this versus reaching out and being an advocate of helping to... deal with the issues when communities and businesses were running into problems with the different agencies. So I think we would still probably argue that the advocate, there were good reasons why the advocate's office was split off. We probably continue to argue that that should exist. In terms of the other pieces of it, I know that a lot of work has been done to getting them together and working as a group. You are correct, they still exist, though, in several places. And whether there's some ways to make that at least more transparent, I think we would be open to looking at that piece of it, so that the public isn't having, and these businesses aren't having problems finding where they need to go throughout the state. Now, the advocate today plays some role there of helping to make that happen, but I think there probably is some work that we could do to make that more transparent and seamless.
Thank you. You may hear more about that. It's Chairman Smith's Economic Development and Transportation Committee that has looked at these with ODOT, DCBS. I forget who all has pockets of them, but I'm glad to have the clarification piece on the advocacy.
Thank you. The Affirmative Action Program is the next program that exists in the governor's office. And again, at one point existed as part of the Department of Administrative Services, separate from the Affirmative Action position, and those have been merged and brought into the governor's office. Extradition process, arrest and return. Again, another item that has found different homes but exists within the governor's office. And then sustainability. Several of these would be the kinds of offices that, even if you chose to say they don't belong here, would just need to be transferred out just as they've been transferred in. If you looked at the governor's office over time and looked at just pure numbers, you would see perhaps an increase that looks very high. But again, over time, there have been units that were spread out throughout state government that have been brought into the governor's office because the work they were doing was really on behalf of the governor, and I think that's been an effort that the legislature has made over the past few years is to true that up. For example, the Natural Resource Policy Office and the Office of Workforce and Education have always really functioned as part of the governor's office, but there was a period of time where they actually were part of the Department of Administrative Services budget. And so some of those things have come over time to try and true it up and say, where does the work actually occur? And on the extradition process, since there were a number of questions last time, after a little while, she's running a little late, but Marty Gleason-Santoff from the governor's office will be here to answer those questions. In terms of performance measures, then turning to page 5, the first thing I will point out is you see Economic Revitalization Team, Minority Women and Emerging Small Business, Affirmative Action and Extradition process here with the primary performance measures. Just to remind everyone, one of the things we are trying to do in the governor's office is really look for what should leadership measures be. Obviously, we have some measures that we follow in state agencies, particularly around the principles that the governor established. So we are watching those throughout state government. On the other hand, we have what I found when I got there is there's been a real struggle with finding measures for, if you will, just the basic leadership functions of a governor's office. So we are actually looking at other states and working with the National Governors Association to look at what some of those are. And, in fact, we're having some conversations with legislative leadership as well because it's also been something that we've seen legislatures struggle with as well of how to do that. So you will see more hopefully coming there. Again, on Economic Revitalization Team, we went through some of these, but I'll just highlight them again. We do have a customer service aspect, and so that's the percentage of the local participants who rank the process as good to excellent.
May I interrupt you again?
Yes.
In the customer service aspect, I had the occasion to talk with a constituent over the weekend, and when a call comes into the governor's office from someone, and let's say they have an issue about something, how are those calls generally fielded?
And you didn't see, and I should have pointed out, under the general administration, is a citizen's representative function. We have a small unit that actually fields calls, and I think we have in here somewhere the number of contacts in a year, and it varies by legislative year and non-legislative year. I think the low is somewhere in the 30,000 contacts, and the high was over 100,000, probably, my guess is, during special session years. But those calls, it depends on where they come in. If they call a general information number, there is that person that everybody's seen in the governor's office sitting in the ceremonial office that fields those calls and directs them hopefully to the right place. A lot of them end up going to the citizen's representative office. From there, the citizen's representative office does, if you will, a triage of who needs to respond to this. Is it one that needs a response, or is it one that somebody just wants to actually register their support or their opposition to something? If it needs a response or a follow-up, then they do a triage on where that should go. So it may go to an agency And it is tracked so that we know the agency has responded, and we will either ask for, yes, we want a response back to us so we can see it first, or copy us, and copy to policy advisors as well so that they know what's going on. In some cases, it will come directly to other staff in the office to be responded to. And they now, one of the newest forms for all of us to get requests for information is the email system. They now receive a large number of the questions through the email system.
And would live humans interact? If I call up, assuming that I'm not calling because I'm thrilled and I want to share that joy with the government's office.
There are a few, and we love those.
But assuming that I have called and I'm upset or unhappy about something, am I talking to humans all the way through, or are there recorders? I mean, obviously after hours there are recorders, but during the day, are there humans?
Madam Chair, yes. Our goal is to always have somebody be able to talk to a human being. There are recording systems, and again, just sheer volume gets into some of that. But the goal then is to have somebody get back to them. And when it goes to an agency, we ask the agency to contact and let people know that they are going to be responded to. Often when we get something in, it will come in writing as well with just an address. There are people who actually do not want to speak to a live human being. But
Senator Morset.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What happens to the for and against complaints that you receive?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, we actually have fairly recently actually been asked our citizens rep office, and I think they were always doing this, but we're actually getting this out more to everybody, to kind of keep a running list, if you will, of bringing to us the couple of pages of what have been the topics and what are people saying. And again, it's just a summary form of for and against, but for example, it is always a good reminder to us of what people are caring about versus what maybe we are seeing here. I think 2 weeks ago when that list came in, the biscuit salvage area was probably one of the number one items on there in terms of comments that came in the office. But they normally, the list is usually a couple pages long of just items that have been called in, yeah. So that we have some sense of that.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I know that my email comes in waves now. You know, school funding now is right. Currently the item, junk food, the civil union contracts and so on. Do you share that? How do you share that among others in other than your office? I mean, do you send, or should you? Maybe you don't need to do that. I was just confused.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, in general we don't, although we're having the conversation about how to get back and make sure we're following up with agencies to ensure that, for example, if there's something on there that we are not as closely tied to directly of knowing what our position is and what's happening, then it's one of those things we're talking about of how do we follow up with agencies to make sure that they are aware this is a huge issue and are you dealing with it. So in effect, to some degree, it's a trigger for us as well of issues that we need to start following or make sure are happening. But beyond that, at this point, we have not shared it publicly and have not seen that would be necessary, although we'd be open to looking at that. And certainly one of the things that we were recently talking about is it might be one of those things that legislative leadership might like to see every couple of weeks, of just having a sense of what the issues are out there.
That's a great idea. Cool. Please continue.
Again, under economic revitalization is making sure how many of our opportunity sites that were identified are actually certified and are project ready. So in other words, it's not okay just to find the sites. We have to make sure they actually get up and are ready for business. And then the number of acres certified as project ready.
Let me interrupt you again. Who's now tracking that? Because I'm going back to the testimony that three of us have heard in the afternoon. We've gone to considerable expense and effort to get these sites up and ready. I happened to drive by one of them over the weekend, and there's just a sign stuck out there that the type is so small you can't read it as you go by at 50 miles an hour. Who's charged with monitoring how well our local partners are performing and what's happening with that land?
Madam Chair, I actually hold Ray Knapp responsible for that, so I might let him come to the table and talk about how he stays on.
Or we can wait until we get to his part of the program. Let's wait till we get to
come back.
We'll get him up here for the full meal deal. So.
Under minority women and emerging small business, they are working on a tracking mechanism to then be able to gather data specifically on the utilization of small businesses in state contracting. And again, the success of the program, there'll be a customer satisfaction piece of that as well. On affirmative action, despite several attempts to do this, it is kind of one of my goals to make sure it actually happens, is to really develop a database that can be used over time to show how we are doing. There's always kind of a tracking of how we're doing at any given time, but it hasn't been developed in a way that says we can really keep that data and look at it over a period of time and actually follow, as agencies change and grow or shrink, how we can follow some of that information. Extradition process, obviously the number of extraditions actually completed. We also have cost efficiency measures on that as well to make sure that we're using the low-cost transportation as much as possible, which obviously then allows us to be able to perform more extraditions. And all of those bottom measures are all related to those cost elements. In general, under cost containment, I think the governor's office still takes very strongly its role in providing leadership on statewide business initiatives that contain the cost of state government services and on trying to constantly be an example of looking at ways to reduce the administrative cost of doing business. Some of those are then continuing to look at business operations for efficiency and cost effectiveness, use of consolidated services, furniture purchases, printing, all of those kinds of things. And in fact, right now, one of the things we're trying to do is also look at ways, as a tenant of this building, to look at ways to have those from the outside who care worry about things like the ceremonial office and upgrading that and dealing with that rather than all those things being a state cost. So I think we look at it in a very broad sense from how agencies do their business to how we do our business. That would lead into one of the things that we've talked about before, which is a number of positions in the governor's office exist actually, or in some cases the position exists in the governor's office, but the funding exists somewhere else. In some cases, the position actually exists somewhere else. And over time, as we've talked about, we've tried to move those in that are truly just a general fund cost into the governor's office proper. In some cases, though, for example, our human services policy advisor is eligible for federal match. And that's one of those kinds of things of constantly looking at ways to make sure that we are spreading the burden of administration to as broad a funding source as possible rather than just making it all general fund. In terms of page 8, it just focuses on what drives the governor's office, and I mentioned we are really a staff-driven organization. I think about 75% of our funds go to personal services or those costs. So the adjustments to the budget are not dissimilar from what you find in any agency that's largely personnel-driven. It's related to salary and flexible benefit adjustments. Obviously, this time not as much there from all of the changes, but the PERS charges, inflation services and supplies, but again, that's fairly small because that's not the primary driver. We only have one policy option package, and that is for the Office of Rural Policy. Moving to page 9, and Kelly, you tell me when I'm stepping on any of the information you're going to go over, but at this point I'll just continue
you
moving.
Staff and you will never step on my toes.
There.
Okay, well, with that, I'll just proceed then. The total budget for the governor's office, if you include all fund types, is a little over $11 million. And again, under that kind of, under the total funds, you see administration about 65%, rest and return about 8%. Again, rest and return, larger number, that's one of the places that is not driven by personal services. It's only a one FTE shop. The rest of that is all the cost of transporting prisoners. Affirmative action, 4%. The economic revitalization team is 16%, Office of Rural Policy 3%, and minority women and emerging small business 4%. If you look at the next page, it just splits it by this combination of things we've talked about. So the general fund is about 77% of the budget, and again, you can see it's administration, arrest and return, and the economic revitalization team. We do have a little bit of lottery funds, and that is the economic revitalization team. When you get into the other funds, you can see they come from a number of places. In some of the cases, they do come, again, from agencies where they have a direct impact. For example, in Citizens Representatives Office, we do charge some of that out to the other agencies, and we kind of do a constant check on where are the number of concerns and questions coming from, and then who does it logically fall to. And then federal funds, 1%, and that is for the Office of Rural Policy. On page 11 on our vacancy report, we do have one half-time position where the funding was from the Department of Energy. We did provide a couple of appendices, and I won't go into all the detail about where the budget comes from in terms of all those other funds, as we've talked about, that come in for various positions, as well as our ending balances. The governor's office does make sure that it is able to balance and has been able to revert money back to the general fund. On page 12, then, policy option package, the one is to continue the Office of Rural Policy. We did begin it on a temporary basis during this last biennium under the executive order. It is a package that has 1.5 FT, but 2 positions. We are looking for about $130,000 in federal funds. The remaining other funds will most likely be assessed back to the appropriate agencies based on what issues ultimately become the scope of the work plan. So as we discussed, Madam Chair, getting this very finely honed as to what this group is going to work on and then looking for the appropriate other funds to fill that. If those aren't there, then we would look at reducing the position.
It's an issue that I'd like to come back and revisit with Mr. Naff, and just by way of establishing my bona fides in this, I come originally from a rural place. I represent rural places now, and I was appointed by Speaker Minnis to serve on the rural policy group when it first formed. And I think that we will need to visit thoughtfully what happens if the federal funds go away, what exactly is the agenda for the group, how we manage the issues that come before that group. Because in the first meetings that I attended before I matriculated to the Senate, it seemed like the agenda was everything.
And Madam Chair, one of the things as we've met with local governments and was out late last week is making sure that we don't use this office to promise all things to all people. It is easy to be out on the road and say, and to run into somebody who says, you know, I've got this issue, you now have a rural policy office, can they take care of it? And making sure that we have a well-defined scope and being able to talk about what the office can really do and get done. Not that they can't be a conduit for questions back in, but not overestimating what 1.5 FT can really do.
Madam Chair.
Representative Crowley.
Thank you. In regards to rural policy, I've served for a number of years now on the NCSL Ag and Rural Development Committee, and we learn a lot about the other best practices that many other states are putting into place in terms of methodologies and ideas, some that are dependent upon government bureaucracies to enact them, others, for instance, the North Carolina legislature grants all of their economic development money to a private nonprofit organization which enacts all of that policy. There's so many variations, so many good things to learn from. I really want to echo the chair's point about this. I think it's going to be important that we focus for a specific time on certain issues and really work those issues and help implement policies at the local level and get things happening and then move on to the next issue. And I think that the prioritization of those would be readily apparent, and I would hope that the Office of Rural Policy would be looking in that direction, and I'd be happy to assist in whatever direction I could there also.
Respectfully, my only comment, having sat at the table, is it's not readily apparent. There is a lot of pent-up demand for resolution to a lot of issues. There are going to be instances where counties, for example, or other units of local government may step forward with contributions, and it raises the question, I'm making this up, but let's say Umatilla County steps forward with a $10,000 grant. Do their issues go to the head of the line? How do you sort accepting money from other units of government and not be influenced by what their concerns are? So it's going to require some discipline, I think, to get a strategic agenda and, just as you say, begin to work away on the problems and have some results and then move to the next.
Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, both are very good points, and one of the things that we're talking about right now is how to make sure we're looking at best practices yeah. not just here but statewide, and looking for opportunities to make sure that the whole idea here is to be able to solve problems as close to the ground and as quickly as possible. And we all have to keep looking at that. In terms of the other piece on the funding, we are going to be very sensitive about the other funds. In my history, I recall when we had a management unit in the executive department that was created to go out and, in effect, be a management, for lack of a better term, SWAT team, to be able to go in when an agency was having problems and deal with issues. Over time, it became an other-funded source, which meant that agencies had to come and ask for the help and pay for that source. And what happened was they ended up doing a lot of filing studies. And not that they weren't things that the agencies couldn't use their services for, but it was much harder to use them in really where you might, from a leadership perspective, say, this is the best use. Because they were, in effect, selling their services to agencies, and sometimes agencies did not want to call them up when it was a real problem issue. So we have to be very sensitive to that here. We don't let the other funds drive the agenda versus making sure that we have the right agenda and then look for the appropriate sources.
Senator Morissette, are you finished?
No, I just wanted to comment that that's another important point about where rural policy seems to gravitate to. And I really like the idea of having a strategic vision for that. I think we need to come together as a state, both the federal entities, the local entities that are involved in rural policy, and certainly the state, and decide what that strategic vision is. And Ted Ferrioli and I have talked a lot about this. And then bite off those chunks and then try to not allow ourselves to be driven in other directions that may be important by the money sources that are available for that. We just can't do everything at once in rural policy. I think we have to figure out what's the most pressing needs, basically, in most rural areas and concentrate on that. And I would really hope that we would establish a summit at some point. And if the governor's office would like to do that, I mean, Ted Ferriola and I have, again, talked about doing that for the last 3 years, doing a summit where we could ascertain really what is rural policy, what are the real world needs for Oregon, and enact, come to agreement on a strategic vision and enact that.
It's the come to agreement piece that's tricky, because when I watched that group convene for the I was at the table when we convened for the first time. There were 18 people at the table, and there were 18 number ones. And so that's where the discipline will have to come from. Senator Morissette.
Thank you. I, too, am interested in rural policy, particularly the rural health care, and I did attend an NCSL conference recently that focused on rural health. Came back and talked to Karen Whitaker immediately about the problem. To me, this is the number one issue in rural areas is health. Hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, long-term care, all of these things. And I have a bill that I hope Ways and Means will hear to put some money into the rural health pot from the unused tobacco funds. But my question is, where does Karen Whitaker fit into this? Is she funded through OHSU, or I doubt if she's one and a half?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, she is not funded through the governor's office. No. I believe she is funded through the Oregon Health Sciences University.
And those programs have been cut, I think.
And what I can't answer today is whether or not she was already on a different funding source than the state general fund, or whether or not she was still part of what the state had supported. We can find that out for you.
Okay. I'm interested, though, in what you're talking about, Representative Krupp. I'd like to be involved in that. Thank you.
Please continue.
Moving along, Citizens Representative Office, and again, we talked a little bit about this already, but how many positions and who funds them. There are five positions. One is in the governor's office, and four, in effect, are funded elsewhere. And you see the four agencies that currently are funding this. And two of them you will see pretty much constantly on there, and that will be the Department of Consumer and Business Services and the Department of Administrative Services. And the reason is because of the volume that they continue over time. While Department of Consumer and Business Services sometimes inside the state is not followed as closely in terms of the business community and the number of concerns that are out there around everything from building codes to safety and health, et cetera. They receive a lot of questions. On the others, we tend to rotate those through state government based on kind of, if you will, a volume, and it's not a precise science, but making sure that everyone in the state helps to fund positions that, in fact, are there to answer citizens' questions. We also have a volunteer unit, and I can't tell you today, but when Ray comes up, he might know the number, of folks who come in and volunteer in that unit. And that has been going on probably for 25 years or more, where volunteers come in and spend some time opening mail and sorting it and being involved, which is a great thing for us and also another way of people becoming educated out there. So, and again, talked about the role, I think we already went through that, but to provide an avenue for citizens and to actively work with others as well. It is different than an ombudsman. It does not have an investigatory function. An ombudsman does. Occasionally, the citizen's representative office will have an issue brought to them that actually needs to be turned over to an ombudsman or to an investigatory kind of issue. But generally speaking, their job is to act as a liaison and make sure the questions get answered.
Madam Chair, maybe.
Senator Morsett.
Yeah, I've always felt that it kind of defeats the purpose to have the ombudsperson under the department that has control. Well, under the department, they should be under the governor's office. I long believe that. And if they're going to conduct an investigation, they have to have some independence to do that. And they can't really do it if they're working for human services, if it's a human services ombudsperson.
Madam Chair, Senator Morsett, that issue I think has been brought up a number of times and discussions have gone on, and I know there's varying opinions about that. At this point, we know there have been, in my history, there have been occasions where the ombudsman, in effect, during a period of time where there's something that's very controversial, in effect, kind of works for a policy advisor rather than works for the department chair if that becomes an issue. But I think that's just a policy discussion that has been taking place a number of times. At this point, we have not talked about moving people into the governor's office. And then page 16 just gives you kind of a recap of some of the numbers that I mentioned. And again, I think it was 2003 when we had just shy of 101,000 contacts in the citizens representative office. 2004 was at 66,000, but you can see they vary to some degree. By and large, we can always count on session years being larger than non-session years in terms of issues being raised, which is very, very normal. So, but it does kind of give you also a sense of the kind of the one that's the most quickly growing is the email from 137 in 1998 to 22,000 in 2004, and is the largest growing area for us.
Be the last time I've whined about my email.
It is one of those amazing, if you will, it's the closest thing to a manufacturing unit that we have in the governor's office, that they really have this down to a science and they go through these things. But again, we're really trying to figure out how to capture this for a couple of reasons. And one is to figure out what the issues are that often one of the things that shows up through this is a place where we have not communicated well, frankly. And making sure that we try and capture this data and use it to not just to respond to each individual concern, but to get ahead of issues and figure out how we do a better job on the front end. With that, we're going to move into the economic revitalization team, and as I promised, Ray would get a chance to come up here. So I think that what I will do is have Ray come on up, if that's all right with you, and start moving through this slide.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morris.
Could we, before we move forward, can we go back to the performance measurements for the minority women and emergency small businesses? This is kind of troublesome to me, in that as long as we have had programs in effect for minority and emerging small businesses, to have a plan to establish a tracking mechanism that will gather reliable and accurate data on utilization of minority women and emerging small businesses in state contracting, that seems to be a pretty weak goal. I would think as long as these agencies have been around, these offices and these activities, that there should be a wealth of information. And then to track the success, I'm just troubled by those measurements, Madam Chair. I'm not sure what to do with them, but it seems to be an interesting commentary, actually, on what we're doing in that arena.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, the one comment I would make on terms of establishing, there is a wealth of information. As you pointed out, it exists in several places. The difference is actually having a database or a mechanism that actually tracks it from a central place versus gathering data externally. And frankly, it's one of those things that funding has limited getting some of that done. But in terms of the second piece on the success, I think we could certainly work with you to do something a little more definitive about what that means. Part of that is a customer service element, obviously, but there's also another piece that sets the goal and the target of what would we call success in terms of what we're doing.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Good morning. It's good seeing
you.
Good morning. This has been one area of interest for me this session. Can you share with the committee the history of why we have multiple minority women and emerging small business entities in different parts of state government?
Representative Smith, I'm delighted to have the witness answer this, but this is something that we've already discussed today, given that three of us, now four of us that you've joined us, all have had this discussion with respect to other...
Did you feel good with the answer?
I did, and I'll repeat the answer just to make sure that I know what Ms. McHugh said, that they personally feel very strongly there ought to be an advocate in the governor's office, but would be very receptive to seeing some kind of a more easily accessible, more clearly defined amalgam of other offices in other places. Is that fair?
Yes, and I'm looking back because later in the document we have a little more that responds to questions. It still doesn't get to all of the detail of the entire history, but probably the one thing I would say just as a general comment, and then we can talk about do we need to do a better history for the committee, is that one of the things that happened over time was a concern that the advocate itself, whose real role isn't to be an advocate for state government but an advocate for the business community, was so closely associated with the clearinghouse and the certification role that there was a view that they weren't really doing their job to be an advocate externally to make sure that government was providing this in an adequate and appropriate means. And that's what drove moving it to a governor's office and separating those roles. And that, we would say, still holds. That is still an issue that I think would be a concern if somehow the advocate's role became really a manager for what state government does here versus being an advocate externally to make sure that government's doing that. But that's separate from whether the others should all.
Follow up Representative Smith.
I apologize. I didn't mean to jump in on an issue that's already been worked. I unfortunately was upstairs. I've just had a lot of trepidation with this area because I'm not convinced that average Oregonians understand what minority women in emerging small businesses does. And I share with the rest of this committee what four of these committee members saw in an economic development, transportation, ways and means committee where I just laid into a person, asking them what they do, what's their outreach, and this poor fella is just taking hit after hit. And then finally, his comment was, I don't do that. And I'm sitting there as chair thinking to myself, if I don't understand what this poor fellow's responsibilities are within this agency, how is the minority entrepreneur in Boardman, Oregon going to know? And I think we have a real problem there, and I don't think we're going to solve that solution here today or come up with a solution here today, but I think that's something that we truly, truly need to be working towards because I personally don't believe that every Oregonian who would be classified as a minority woman or emerging small business truly knows what services are available to them, nor has any clue on how to reach out to an advocate that may be there to serve them. And I say that truly in the interest of trying to make a difference on this, but we're truly fooling ourselves if we think we've even achieved one-tenth of what we ought to be doing.
What we might do, given that Representative Smith serves as the chair of the committee that's hearing some of these agencies with pockets of minority small women As well as here, we might discuss with the co-chairs the possibility of giving some suggestion by way of a budget note to ask that the agencies all get together and figure out an easier way to amalgamate those functions. Mine's just as simple as, how do you find it in the phone book?
Well, or at the very least, Madam Chair, to deal with the outreach and transparency issue, making sure that the communities that should be able to access that know how to and are able to do that.
Which may
lead to a performance measurement connection there.
I think you have a hammer without a handle. And I think it would be incumbent upon this committee and the afternoon committee to put a handle on that hammer and make it a tool worth having.
I'm going to, for the purpose of this budget and this committee, ask Dallas to capture this as one of the issues that we want to come back to, not only strengthening the performance measure, or at least revisiting the performance measure, but also a broader discussion with the co-chairs and Chair Smith's committee about how we give guidance to see about an amalgamation here or some kind of streamlining and transparency.
Okay. With that, I'll turn it over to Ray, starting on page 17.
Good morning, Mr. Knapp.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ray Knapp, Director of Intergovernmental Relations. Moving into the Phase 2 budget questions that you had, on page 17, with respect to the Economic Revitalization Team, the question was asked, how is the team staffed and what is the role? There are 7 positions in the Economic Revitalization Team. There are 5 regional coordinators, 1 project coordinator, 1 support staff. The regional coordinators are located, as you can see, throughout the state: Milton Freewater, Madras, Central Point, Salem, and Beaverton. And the Economic Revitalization Team is led by yours truly.
Mr. Knapp, before you move forward, could you give us the names of these souls in Milton Freewater, Madras, Central Point?
Milton Freewater is Sherry Davis.
Very good lady.
Very good lady. Madras is Janet Brown. Central Point is Jeff Griffin. Salem is Eric Anderson. And Beaverton is Mark Ellsworth.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Basically, the overarching mission of the revitalization team is to increase economic opportunity and assist state agencies in improving government accountability by focusing on customer service, partnerships, and results. As you'll remember, in the last session of the legislature under House Bill 2011, the Community Solutions Team, which had been the historic name, was redefined and renamed as the Economic Revitalization Team, and charged it with several main issues. One, increasing the supply and marketability of industrial lands, providing coordinated assistance to local government and business, and simplifying and expediting state agency permitting processes. We have attached, for your further information, in the back of the book, Appendix G, which is the biennial report to the 73rd Legislative Assembly. Moving on to page 18, at the statewide level, the ERT operates on what I refer to as basically 2 different levels. Statewide level, we work with state agency directors to focus state resources towards activities that improve the economy and service delivery of our agencies. And then at the local or regional level, which refers back to the 5 coordinators we just spoke about, again, trying to provide access to state government and really convene state, local, and federal partners to resolve issues that face local municipalities or entities. We try to leverage funding for projects at the local level. The regulatory efficiency group of state agency directors we've listed for you, there are 8 agencies that comprise the Economic Revitalization Team, and we've listed them for you there, OECDD, Department of Transportation, and so on and so forth.
Smith, we're Manager. Shy one of these, if you, at your convenience.
Okay. I actually have an extra I'll give to you right now.
Now, there's...
Service.
Customer service in action. Thank you, sir.
The next question is, how does the Revitalization Team interact with Oregon Economic and Community Development Department? And I would say that there is a very close relationship and a close interaction, especially with respect to getting the industrial land certification process up and running. The department's business development officers, the BDOs, actually identified sites in their region, and there are business development officers working throughout the state. Our regional coordinators, the ERT 5 regional coordinators, both individually and in partnership with those business development officers, contacted the local communities. And if the communities expressed an interest in moving forward, then the team set forth to identify barriers to development of a particular piece of property. And those barriers could include, as listed, land use, funding for infrastructure improvements, cleanup of contamination, or resolving wetlands or other environmental issues. The department's community development coordinators work with local governments to gather the actual data needed for each certification notebook. I think some of you have seen these certification notebooks. They're really quite complex books of information on each of the available sites. And through the efforts of this joint effort coordinated with the community, the gathering of information necessary to present to a third-party verifier so that that individual could go through that verification process and say, yes, you've taken care of A, B, C, D, and E. Beyond,
Mr. Neff, how much money do you think we've spent in toto bringing these sites up to speed?
Senator, I don't know the answer to that question because I don't really know from OECD's standpoint how much in terms of staff time we could probably get that information for you. I can't answer that.
I think that, and you're probably the wrong person to ask, it might be something that I'd ask the chair of the afternoon sub on transportation and economic development to flag. It seems to me if we're going to figure out some kind of a return on investment, knowing how much we've spent, total of how much we've spent, would be very useful. If you would mind querying OECD about that.
Can you? I have quite a few queries.
I'll accept that query as mine.
Okay.
We're happy to help. Okay.
Madam Chair,
it's a good
Senator Morissette.
Seems to me you would do it in a gradation of immediate, near future, long term future, so on, because I think otherwise you're not going to get an answer that makes sense.
Senator Smith, Representative Smith,
Georgia Johnson. In my part of Oregon, we're very well served by our economic revitalization team member. And we're also very well served by our business development officer. We're fortunate to have both. The question I have, though, is can you help this committee visualize the difference between the two? I'm a visual person, and I put kind of a T account, if you will. Tell me what an economic revitalization team member can do that a business development officer can't. And vice versa, if you will.
Chairman Johnson, Representative Smith, I think that the distinction that I would draw is the economic revitalization coordinator has a much greater capacity to bring into the problem resolution members of other agencies, the local community, and works at coordinating the actions. The business development officer, specifically from the Department of Economic Development, has a more narrowly defined role in terms of attraction of a business expansion, very specific focus on the business element of it. The other elements that might go into this in terms of potential conflicts with DLCD or with DSL, with wetlands mitigation, it might be a transportation issue. That is where the ERT coordinator says, okay, all of us need to come to the table together and resolve that, bring the local community or municipality in, and work towards gaining forward momentum on that particular project. So that's the coordinator has a much larger, more expansive view of the world than a business development officer does.
So who answers to who? Does the business development officer answer to the ERT team member?
No, they don't answer to the coordinator, Representative Smith. What they basically do, it's just, I would define it as a team relationship. I think that There's a great sensitivity, as with any team. Each team member doesn't want to not do something and let another team member down. So it's more the force and effort of the team and itself working together.
And Madam Chair, Representative Smith, if I may follow up, I think if you looked at our history, one of the reasons this existed is looking at, I guess, probably one of the examples that was out there early was when we first started prison expansion. And we looked at prison expansion and said, we know how to build a prison. And everything was around building a prison and the infrastructure side of that prison. But nobody dealt with the issues where the community said, wait a minute, what about our educational system? What about the housing that we don't have? What about the water that we don't have? You're bringing all these jobs in. That's great. But you haven't dealt with the other issues in our community state that are just as real to us to be able to deal with this. That's kind of the example of what this kind of team is designed to do, is to say there are many issues that are there. Ultimately, if it became an issue, if we had one of our ERP members really in a conflict with the business development officer, it would raise up through the agency and through the governor's office, because it would be a fundamental issue for that community.
I'm just trying to figure out, please know my comments are directed at trying to just decipher who does what, because we're very well served. They're both excellent. But it seems like we have two people carrying out a lot of the same functions, and I wonder, and maybe that's just because they're both hard workers. I mean, I don't know. But I know when industry comes to our part of the state and it's time to sit down, chances are both individuals are at the table.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, one of the other things that I would point out is I talked about the coordinator having a larger vision of the world. The coordinator may well sit down in many of the same meetings where the business development officer is, but in addition to that, the coordinator really acts as more of a, I will use the term ombudsman, for example, in the community of Hines. They had some buckling sidewalks that they laid at ODOT's doorstep. And so in this particular case, the coordinator, Sherry Davis, worked with ODOT singly, brought them together with the community, resolved the issue of the sidewalks, got it repaired. And so there's just a broader array of projects that the coordinator would have been involved in. It's not just economic development. It's also acting as an ombudsman, if you will, for any state agency that a municipality might encounter a difficulty with or have questions about, bring those individuals together, see if we can't get resolution to the problem and move forward.
That helps.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In response to the issue you raised, Representative Smith, I believe that the economic revitalization team either actually is, or if not, can be one of the most important issues in helping the economic development of our state. And it comes simply from the standpoint of the chief executive officer of the state can help lead to a yes and find ways to solve problems. And I know from my own personal experience that when you get down into agencies, there are agendas that are personal and not necessarily either statutory or administrative rule that will tend to throw roadblocks in progress. And the ability to wade into this from the chief executive position is it's a huge and powerful tool to help solve problems. And I just very much endorse what's the intent and hopefully the delivery of this office.
Can I add to that?
Representative Smith.
I echo your comments, Senator Morse. What I would like to see, if I were governor for a day, would be to take your economic revitalization team members and give them even more ability to wrap up deals, to pull the trigger, if you will, on a deal. And I think, during the interim, if there's a way to work to determine what are those little gaps that we could help strengthen these teams with, to fill those gaps, to strengthen the teams, I think we ought to be looking at that. I've used this example before, and I'll use it again. And we've got a strategic reserve fund. How powerful it would be for somebody from the state of Oregon to be able to look a business owner right in the eye and say, we can make this happen, and we'll fill that hole. And you know it's done. And know that they have the ability and the responsibility and the accountability of being able to do it. It happens all the time in the private sector. If I was a senior lender in a bank and I was at the table, I have the ability to pull the trigger and know that if I pull it wrong too many times, I'll be looking for a new job. But at the same time, I also have the ability to make projects happen and to advance the mission of the institute I'm working for. And I think we ought to do the same thing with these people. So,
please continue.
Moving on to page 20, the question, provide details of the work plan. We have attached for your information and reference a series of appendices. Unless the committee is anxious for me to do so, I didn't plan on going through each of those appendices step by step. There's quite a bit there, but I would be more than happy to respond to any questions that you have. Our focus for the 2005-07 biennium is to simply increase economic opportunity and accountability by identifying and elevating policy and processes issues to the 8 state agency directors and the Office of Regulatory Streamlining for resolution. And then, as I mentioned earlier, to have our regional coordinator serve as governor's office ombudsman to local governments and businesses. We have provided on page 21 a sampling of the kinds of activities that we do with the Economic Revitalization Team Work Plan, and the appendix that's attached goes into specifically, we define the issue, the expected resolution, and a deliverable for each of those 7 items that you see listed on page 21. I might point out that there was some conversation earlier about rural Oregon, and number 7 listed there, small rural communities often have difficulty accessing state government resources. As many of you know, that simply is what I refer to as a lack of capacity. Many of our rural communities are just simply so small they may have only a recorder to assist the city or the community itself in moving forward, and simply just don't know where to go to contact government. Madam Chair.
I'm going to use an example in my district to ask this question, and let me set up the question first. It is, to what degree the ERTs, and I still wish they were CSTs, but the ERTs, are proactive rather than reactive. I turn to your Appendix E, and I was just looking at those things that are in progress or completed. And I think we all have a tendency to gravitate immediately in a display like this to those things that we know the best. And I certainly am very familiar with Port Westward in my district. This is a site that, if everything goes according to plan, will have a PGE gas turbine fired power generating facility on it. With the tumult now about what's going to happen with PGE and this whole Port Westward resting on an urban renewal district that has to have all the legs on the stool, if for some reason that power generating plant falls off, the whole thing, in my opinion, collapses. And what I'm trying to figure out is how proactive are the economic revitalization teams in asking the sorts of questions. There are a number of options about what could happen to PGE, and how engaged are they to say, if options 1 through 3 happen, the generating plant is probably fine. After option 4, it's definitely off the table. I'm making this stuff up. Option 5, maybe. And to take some proactive role in knowing about these kinds of issues and then being ahead of whatever happens and able to weigh in from some thoughtful perspective.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think that my general response to your question is that the individual teams that are located throughout the state try to be very proactive. I think that, as with any number of teams, you have varying levels of being proactive. But clearly one of the issues is that it is important to understand that there many of these projects that you will see and hear about are complicated, they're long term, and there are other issues that can come in from the side. And so the direction that the teams have is to be as proactive as possible and not only just react to what's occurring, but to be thinking about what is it that potentially might occur that could either stimulate and or hold up development of a project, and work through those issues as necessary. I think that's done with varying degrees of success from time to time, quite frankly.
Okay.
That basically concludes the presentation on economic revitalization team. If there are no further questions there, we'll move on to the Office of Rural Policy on page 22. What has happened and where is the program going? Again, as you are aware, the executive order was signed in late April of 2004. After quite an extensive and elongated search, we did hire an executive director, Mr. Jim Azzamano, in October of 2004, formed the advisory committee in December. The committee is required to meet quarterly. However, they have already met on four different times, and it was referenced earlier that one of the issues of the Office of Rural Policy is maybe refining and defining with more clarity a fewer number of issues rather than a larger number of issues. The advisory committee has gone through a work session where they've attempted to do that and gotten some training, because there really is a tendency to have 18 different players and 18 different views of what the office should be doing. And so we're really trying to refine that more carefully. The question was asked, can we combine the program with economic revitalization? I think the two teams work very, very closely together. Both of the revitalization team and the Office of Rural Policy report through the Intergovernmental Relations Director. But the distinction that I would make is that the Office of Rural Policy, is the intent is more to have it a policy-related office, an office that can advise the governor, the legislature, the agencies on policies that relate to rural Oregon, versus the economic revitalization team, which is often involved in projects. And I make that distinction. Senator Morissette, you had referenced rural health policy. Those are policy issues. Those aren't project-related things like developing transportation and water infrastructure for an industrial site. And so I would make that distinction. But clearly, there is a very close role between the two. The shared vision is that of simply providing better service and accountability from state government to our municipalities and citizens throughout the state. If federal funding falls through, where will the funding come from, or does it fall flat? We would simply review our options with current programs, work with the legislative branch for further funding. Federal funding requirements, start and completion dates. There are some measurements in terms of investments promoted by in private enterprise and job creation in economically distressed communities. We obviously have a number of reporting functions quarterly and annually to the federal government for the activities of the rural policy, which are being carried out by the director. The work plan is Appendix H. We have listed it for you beginning on page 24. And I think that this may not alleviate some of the concerns that some of you have, because if you look at it, it's really quite extensive. There are a number of areas there, and I think one of the things that the director and the advisory committee will be doing is working on the office cannot be all things to all people, as it's been stated here in the committee. And clearly the effort needs to be, are there a series of most important issues that we can function on or focus on, i.e. economic development in rural Oregon, health care in rural Oregon, those kinds of things, and try and narrow our focus and succeed in three or four areas and then pick another three or four.
I guess just my observation in looking at this list and seeing the considerable potential for overlap, I call your attention to page 3. The Office of Rural Policy will explore the increased emphasis on business retention for small business and entrepreneurs. You've got the ERT doing that to some degree. You've got the BDOs doing that to some degree. You've got these guys doing that to some degree. How do we get to a point where we look like a box of mice somebody tipped over?
That's a great visual. Running around in a billion different directions.
Madam Chair, excellent question. I think that would be one of the
areas. And so well put.
I think that is one of the areas that we need to focus and refine. And quite frankly, as this Office of Rural Policy has gotten up and running, it's been, we have found education is a key component. And by education, I mean education of what the Economic Revitalization Team does versus what the Office of Rural Policy does, because the potential for overlap is definitely there. And that has required us to have regular meetings to sit down between myself, the coordinators, Mr. Azzamano, and discuss the kinds of issues that are being raised and say, wait a minute, that really is an issue for the Economic Revitalization Team. So from now on, if someone references you or wants you to do some of that, why don't you act as a telephone operator, if you will, just plug them into the appropriate coordinator. They should deal with that. So I think that type of communication and coordination is incumbent upon us to ensure that we don't act like a bunch of mice that have been tipped out of a box.
That sounds great, but it sounds like a bunch of meetings to worry about not running into each other. And I guess I'm looking for something just a little more concrete. You've got business retention. You've got streamlining. We've got another Office of Regulatory Streamlining right now. And it just concerns me that somebody's going to have to exercise, and I think that somebody is you, some discipline here to make sure that we're not like veneer. Very thin, very spread out, but at the end of the day, we don't have much to check off the done list. Representative Krupp?
I'm fine.
Oh, okay.
Madam Chair, I think it's an excellent point, and I think all of us, when we looked at the work plan, said, obviously, this isn't going to get done, and even if you separate the other issue, making sure that we're not overlapping and doing work that somebody else is already taking care of is the issue of just getting something done and being very focused. And so I think kind of the idea of narrowing the scope and being very focused in on what this office is going to do, knowing very well that people will want to come and bring other issues there, sometimes legitimately because they aren't being dealt with and sometimes perhaps because they aren't happy with how things are proceeding, and that we don't have it become just another citizens' representative function, but make sure that we're staying focused on what we can achieve.
Telecommunications piece, working on the excellent work that Senator Nelson has done, strikes me as one of the easiest. I mean, it's a very complicated issue, but were the Office of Rural Policy to take that on and make sure that the fiber goes all the way to the end of the lane everywhere, what a remarkable accomplishment it would be for them to own that piece. But when you get off into some of this more esoteric stuff that is very difficult to measure, I just am concerned and would look to Mr. Naff for leadership on making sure that everybody, we've got some things we can check off the done list at the end of the day.
Madam Chair, I hear you. Okay, if you'll turn to page 26, please, under Minority Women and Emerging Small Businesses, a little bit of additional detail that was discussed earlier. The mission of MWESB as it relates in the Governor's Office is to advocate for and promote programs to improve government business opportunities for minority women and emerging small businesses. It was created in 1987. By statute, authority is given to the Governor to make an appointment to the position, with the office being in the Governor's office, and specifically the role of the advocate is to be the voice of minority women and emerging small business owners in Oregon and to work with certified businesses seeking government contract opportunities. There are two positions in the office, the executive manager, who serves as an advisor to the Governor, also serves as an advocate for the program. And the question was asked earlier, how do people know about this? One of the primary events, if you will, is an annual Governor's Marketplace Conference, which is a one-day event for small businesses to learn about how to do business with the state, marketing, and so on and so forth. It's generally held in the Portland metropolitan region in early fall, late fall. In addition, the clearinghouse manager oversees the management and administration of the Oregon Opportunity Register and Clearinghouse and notifies vendors of contract opportunities in different small business events. Does this office overlap with other agencies? Consumer and Business Services does have a similar program. It's charged with providing certification services to these businesses who meet the eligibility criteria. The office within DCBS does not provide training programs or technical advice on doing business with the state. So there's this distinction there. The Office of Civil Rights at ODOT has oversight for the Federal Disadvantaged Business Enterprise Program, a very specific application. How does one find this? That was a question also asked earlier. The Governor's Office website, the Secretary of State Business Center website, and appearances are made on the part of the advocate at numerous chamber meetings, and minority informational sessions are held around the state. Questions about MWESB? Moving on to the Affirmative Action Office, how do you measure the goals in place? Several different measures. Simply the statistical, are there fewer discrimination issues, fewer dollars being paid out by the state in terms of settling discrimination claims, the number of employees that are aware of their actions, affirmative action representatives and plans, stronger relationships, commitment, and results of hiring with the Oregon tribes, and a higher retention rate as measured by the state for people of color, disabilities, or women. The office actually started with the Straub administration being in the governor's office. It's been there ever since. And there are two positions in the Office of Affirmative Action, one executive manager and one program manager.
Okay. With that, then, arrest and return was one of the other areas. Last time there were some questions, and I'd like to ask Marlene Satoff from our office, our legal counsel, to come forward and answer any questions about the extradition process or that specific unit.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Marty Lynn Sathoff. I'm the governor's general counsel, and it appears to me from the materials from the last session that you have one main question of me, and that is, why is arrest and return, the extradition process, in the governor's office, and would it be more efficient in another agency? The simple answer is that it's in the governor's office because by statute it's the governor who has the authority and the responsibility for extraditing prisoners. Generally, I could go a little further than that. It's also the way it's done in almost all the other states. We have interstate agreements. The governor has had the constitutional authority that revolves around his role in making sure that people, prisoners going from our state and coming to our state are safe and kept safe. So we have policy reasons for that. We have policy call on that as well. An additional sort of non-statutory but policy reason is that by its nature, the arrest and return process is really a cross-jurisdictional process. We work with 36 counties, all the DAs. We work with the parole board. We work with other states' DAs. We work with other states' Department of Corrections. It becomes almost a cross-jurisdictional process of getting prisoners back and forth across the state lines to where they belong so that their criminal charges can be carried out. You have any other questions?
This is a related question. It doesn't deal with arrest and return. I just got a call yesterday from a woman who's concerned about a granddaughter marrying an illegal Mexican alien and has to go back and so on. Does the governor's office deal with these sorts of things at all?
Illegal aliens?
Well,
per se?
A Mexican alien who is here illegally wants to establish himself, is married, has a child, but is being sent back.
We get involved at the level at which a crime has been committed and that person is arrested. If the person has not been arrested in some way, then of course we wouldn't get involved in the issue of the marriage and whether that's going to help this person stay here legally. The other way we get obviously involved is under the in terms of illegal aliens has to do, quite frankly, with the federal requirement that certain not illegal aliens, but certain crimes committed by people who are here on visas have to go back automatically, and we get involved in those. The issue that you're talking about, has a person been arrested yet? Then we wouldn't be involved in that.
Thank you. I wouldn't have wanted to get it. Thank you, Mr. Chair, in this area, but
I'm still not sure I want to. The answer to Senator Morrison's question was unless they're arrested. Are you implying that you do get involved at the point of arrest?
No, I'm sorry. I should have, members of the committee, I should clarify. I was taking it the next step further. Had the person been arrested and then they came into the extradition process, then that's where we would be involved. We don't, the governor's office doesn't get involved in the day-to-day arrests of right.
There was no nexus there.
Making another jump to the extradition.
After everything the city of Portland has gone through right. with when yeah. to get involved,
I just wanted to make sure we were completely clear on the record.
Okay. Finally, the last question we received was around sustainability and are we achieving the goals that were set out? And we wanted to come back and make sure we did establish the executive order. Under the order, agencies are to complete sustainability plans. 20 agencies have done so, and frankly, we have focused on the larger agencies. That's where this focus was, to make sure that those who are more likely to be involved in sustainability issues from what we normally think of as natural resource agencies, but, for example, the Department of Administrative Services, for example, in purchasing and construction and fleet also has a role there, and they have completed their plans. And agencies are starting to now work on the next piece, which is to establish the performance measures around sustainability.
Do those plans exist in an amalgamated form somewhere?
Madam Chair, I believe, yes, they do.
How tough would it be to get them?
Madam Chair, we can provide those for you.
Are there best practices that the agencies were able to tee off one off another, or did everybody start with a blank piece of paper?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, they really did not start with a blank piece. In all that, there was a lot of direction from the Sustainability Board on some of those kinds of practices that everybody should have in place. And, for example, we didn't have every agency to establish those around purchasing or fleet, et cetera. Those were done more centrally and then shared. Some agencies did have unique items that were unique to them, and then the Department of Energy has been particularly helpful in this regard to take kind of a lead on some of those that should be established and then used by all agencies. And that concludes our prepared presentation.
Any questions? Then I think what we would do is to ask Mr. Friel, do you have any comments?
Madam Chair, no. You do have my handout that gives you some overview of the governor's budget, but I don't think any information that you don't already have is it as a reference document.
Okay. I am then going to turn to Ms. Winan and sort of ask for. You have a memorandum for us, and we anticipate at this point doing only public testimony today, hearing the high-level overview, asking for any testimony, and then if you'd like to comment on your memorandum or just leave it as it sits, whatever your pleasure is.
I would like, yeah, Madam Chair, just if you haven't had the opportunity yet to read my brilliant memo. Yeah, I would. There's some issues around funding for the economic revitalization team and Office of Rural Policy. The last session, when the team was codified in a bill, funding was kind of, as I termed it, cobbled together with some other funds. At that time, it was going to come from a fund in economic development, some lottery funds, and some general fund. We were hoping to get a proposed funding stream, permanent funding solution, if you will. Not a stream, that implies revenue, but a solution, a policy for this. And the governor's budget pretty much has the same split of funding, other funds, lottery fund, and general fund for the economic revitalization team. Again, the Office of Rural Policy, there the funding is federal funds and also monies from some agencies. So the other funds for economic revitalization come from assessments of specific state agencies, as does those. The ones for rural policy hadn't yet been identified, I believe, at the time of the governor's recommended budget, but the intent was we were going to take some cash from some certain, at that time, unidentified state agencies. So whether that's the direction the legislature is comfortable with as a funding mechanism for
these offices that that your staff that I'd rather see a preference to be a more stable as a policy decision how these should be funded. Economic revitalization, under just the terminology, lends itself to thinking towards lottery fund. And last time, I'll share this with members of the committee, we had some discussions about whether it was better, since the beneficiaries of the activity seem to be local jurisdictions, whether use some of the money, I think there's 2.5% of lottery that goes to counties, whether this should be off of the top of that or not. So those questions are still not, and they're still there, or we can just adopt the governor's recommended budget. We don't have a recommendation yet. We're not going to work session, but I did want to point that out and clarify a little bit the reasoning for the discussion on these three and the funding sources. Sustainability also has, we don't have a funding stream, although the staff is, I guess, funded out of another agency. So
I would only add to that that particularly with respect to the economic revitalization team, some of that work may also occur in Representative Smith's committee in terms of looking for a sustainable funding stream for that work. I personally remain very committed to the idea that as long as the economic revitalization team is functioning, that carrying the card with the imprimatur of the governor on it makes a great deal of difference about their ability to convene and gather folks to a table. And I think having them continue to be associated with the governor's office gives them the kind of leverage that they need out in the field. But there might be some options as we move through some of the work in Representative Smith's committee to look at possibilities there. But I think the main reason that I wanted Dallas to comment on this memo is while we're not going to work session, it certainly identifies some of the thinking that LFO has, and I would commend to the committee that this might be these might be issues that we would all cogitate on and come back in work session prepared to advance some suggestions about where we go from here. Representative Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The commentary on the cell phones is an interesting addition in your memo. If you'd like to elaborate on that,
sure.
And it's in the context of the question I had raised in the DAS budget with respect to what is the number of phones that exist in the state and what is the expense.
Let's get everybody caught up. It came on the front of the presentation notebook with the blue cover, but if for some reason you don't have it, I can...
That's all right. I have it upstairs.
The comment I made, this is one of the things we communicate is the results of any audits, and in the governor's recommended budget, they said, well, at some point in time, I think during the financial audit or some other audit, the Secretary of State had found that there were some people in the governor's office that were reimbursing the state for their personal use of the cell phone, their cellular phones that they've been assigned to because of their work. And I guess the practice is use your own phone. You do not reimburse the state. There was another one that two people had been reimbursed for the same expense. The person who was there erroneously reimbursed had paid it back, but for some reason, the modest division felt that it was worthy of comment. The cell phone issue, we don't have an inventory of them. I do not believe.
And Madam Chair, in terms of practice, you will see a combination of things. You'll see people who have a single cell phone and they are paying for it on their own, and then you'll see people you probably run into staff that have two phones, and one is their personal and one is their state. The only time now you would see a reimbursement to the state is if somebody accidentally picked up the wrong phone and
some of your colleagues are running out of belt space to hang.
Yes, they are. Yes,
devices.
They are. But this under this was something under the previous administration as cell phones were becoming more of a tool, became a major issue, and some of the reimbursements were really quite large, and so that's where we've gone to the other route of people dissecting that.
I think given that Dallas is the common professional staff between this budget and DAS, Senator Morris is on to something that I think is very interesting. We're talking here about a trifling amount of money, a $21 expense, and whether or not it's been reimbursed to two different people and under what circumstances. And yet we do not have an adequate inventory of how many phones exist in state government. I am hopeful that Ms. Warner understands the question from this panel, and I think that that might be an issue that we would need to get resolved before her budget moves forward.
We'll make sure that.
Well, it seems to me that it's one of critical interest, and we're wasting a lot of time and energy on a $21 reimbursement when we don't know how many instruments actually exist.
Actually, those were two different things. I also pointed it out. It was in the governor's,
being an old auditor, I didn't think either of them really worthy of a lot of comment, and then have it brought up at $21 reimbursement as a significant item out of an audit by audit solution, I thought was something this committee might be interested in.
Well, I think it's something that we would want to remember when we get into the audits division, just to what degree are these audits actually getting to pertinent and penetrating issues that rise to a policy discussion, and when we're chasing $21 down a rabbit hole. That is not to say that it isn't important to make sure that there's accuracy in these accounts, but I don't know if this rises to the level of an audit discussion. Any other comments from the committee? Because with... Oh, Representative Smith.
I just have a quick question on capital outlay. How come... there's such a significant reduction in automobile or automotive and aircraft from the agency's request, well, also from the last session and the agency's request to the recommended budget.
Yeah, that's okay. I'm just conferring here with staff, and it is where we thought. This is in the arrest and return area.
It's in the what?
In the arrest and return area. And it is a... It is, Kelly, do you want to go ahead and give
sure.
the detail? We're moving to a more cost-effective means of transportation generally.
Yeah. Madam Chair and Representative Smith, all the capital...
Would you identify yourself,
I'm
please?
Kelly Stills with the Department of Administrative Services.
Thank you.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. All of that money was in the arrest and return program, and it's used to buy vans and equipment, related equipment for extradition. And in looking at their spending pattern for this next biennium, we didn't anticipate they're going to need all about $200,000. So we removed all of about $50,000 based on what their needs are.
So our governor still has a decent rig to drive around.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, this is separate to that unit, and okay. and there is no aircraft in the governor's budget.
Although that raises a particular pet issue of mine, and forgive me for dragging my past professional life into this, I think the chief executive officer of this state, regardless of who it is, what party affiliation, ought to have access to an aircraft.
I agree.
Pendleton is no less deserving of seeing their chief executive officer in person than Portland. And in order to make cost-effective use of the governor's time, there ought to be an airplane available. And it doesn't have to be an old beat-up public service aircraft. It can be a serviceable aircraft, and it's something that at some point in time when the finances of the state are a little healthier, I think we ought to look at very seriously.
Madam Chair, I think we would agree that it has been noticed, I think, by the rural parts of the state, the issue that's arisen since a governor and, frankly, leadership does not have access. And that's one of the things that I think is worthy of discussion as well, is not just the governor, but, for example, as your committee went out on the road, I think they found that connection to more parts of Oregon very valuable. And these larger states, this is a huge issue. We have been created. For example, the governor did attend a meeting last week with the four governors in Spokane, and luckily the state of Washington was willing to stop by with their aircraft and pick up the governor to get to the meeting.
Well, that's
to the
humiliating. Having a sister state giving our governor a ride. Or our governor out
we
of
are,
the
We
road.
Are willing to do what we need to get. The bottom line is he does spend a large amount of time in a vehicle because of that.
Well, I would just close by saying this has to be a thoughtful acquisition. It has to be an appropriate aircraft, appropriate to the weather and the topography, and it has to be maintained and with appropriate flight crew commensurate with the carrying the chief executive officer of the state.
Okay. Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Talking about the in-state and out-of-state travel, I noticed in the orbits, we have approximately $312,000 for in-state and $322,000 for out-of-state. Is that primarily used for renting planes for in-state and
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, in the time I've been there, we have rarely rented planes for travel. I can't say it hasn't happened, but to my recollection, in the last almost year I've been there, we have not engaged in renting a plane for travel. The governor primarily uses this vehicle. Again, that would be our total budget for all of the pieces. So, again, for out-of-state, again, you have the issue of the extradition and arrest and return in that as well. But it is the total budget for everyone for traveling in the state. And, again, it includes all those other areas.
Any other questions for Ms. McHugh or any of her staff? I noticed that we have been joined by Ms. Sethoff, and I think we were... Oh, I apologize. You have happened already. Thank you. Under the very efficient gavel of Senator Morris, we got you. While I've been dawdling out in the hallway, thank you very much. There being no additional questions or comments, then I think that we are going to adjourn the... was there a testimony sheet signed up, and did anyone... Okay. In that case, absent any additional comments or questions, I'm going to adjourn the public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 5512, the Office of the Governor. And we will anticipate rescheduling to finish the work on this budget.
Thank you.